Can the authors behind the mega seller Game Change replicate the formula in their new book Double Down? Our cover reviewer this week, Michael Kinsley, has a clear answer to that.
So you have these two very opaque guys, and everyone trying very hard to weave theories around them that will keep people interested.
How do fringe movements shift the mainstream? Alyssa Court, author of Republic of Outsiders, will be here to explain.
They're using social media, they're using their communities to get messages that are often really unexpected across.
Of the thousands of picture books published this year, which ones are the very best? Our children's book editor, Sarah Smith, is here to talk about the 2013 Best Illustrated Books.
This is not a book you just flip through. This is a book that you lay open on a table and then stare at.
Julie Bosman joins us with notes from the field, and Greg Coles has bestseller news. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 150,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/bookreview.
This week marks the publication of Double Down, Game Change 2012 by Mark Halperin and John Heilman, a successor or follow-up to their big book, Game Change, about the election of 2008. And joining us now to talk about his cover review this week is Michael Kinsley. Michael is probably one of the best equipped people to talk about this book, a longtime political reporter and columnist and editor who I think has worked basically at every news outlet, the Los Angeles Times, Time, founding editor of Slate, Crossfire, Bloomberg View, and is now the editor at large of The New Republic. Mike, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
So, you went into this book, reading this book, having read Game Change, right?
Yeah, well, I didn't read it with the thoroughness of a reviewer, the original Game Change, but I did read it, yes.
What were your thoughts going into Double Down based on that, the light reading of Game Change?
I was hoping that like Game Change, it would be full of juicy anecdotes, which it is, but I was also wondering, how are they going to overcome a fundamental problem, which is that 2012 just wasn't as interesting as 2008. And they didn't have, for example, Sarah Palin to play with.
Right. Romney being a less lively character, perhaps. But of course, there was that long Republican primary run-up where it seemed that, you know, there were sort of every out there candidate was a favorite at one point. Did that provide drama to the story?
Yeah, well, a little. You know, it's not so much that Romney didn't have any character. He's a fascinating figure in many ways, but he's sort of opaque, and you know, you can't really get at him. And the same is true of Obama. So you had these two very opaque guys, and everyone trying very hard to weave theories around them that will keep people interested. The candidates in the Republican primary, as you look back on it, it sort of seems like a dream or a nightmare, perhaps. They were so weird, and the likelihood that any of them would ever get elected president seems preposterous, but the authors of the book have to, of course, take them very seriously. I don't think they had to take them quite as seriously as they did.
So Michelle Bachmann, Donald Trump, each of these people gets their sort of turn.
Sure. Or I can't even remember the name of the businessman.
Oh,
Herbert Cain.
Right, pizza.
Yeah.
That's the salient point that jumps out. I mean, part of what you talk about in your review is the difficulty, really, of doing these kind of post-election books. And the model, of course, of that was the
Teddy White
books. What's changed? What's made it so hard to do now?
Let me see where to begin. The campaigns, everything is much more professionalized now. So things that used to be done by volunteers are now done by expensive consultants, and therefore they're polished to a nice high sheen, which didn't used to be true. Theodore White was the first person to sort of show that, that campaigns could be interesting. And from him, in just a few decades, we've gone to what we have now, which is, I would call it the Politico culture in Washington. Politico is a website and a paper publication that reports every detail of everything they can get their hands on, sort of little tidbits of information, relevant or irrelevant, they post them. And they've transformed certainly political journalism and you could argue politics.
In 1960, Teddy White obviously was showing us a kind of behind the scenes of things that weren't endlessly televised and tweeted, so they were new and insightful and kind of lifting back the curtain, whereas now it's very hard, I would imagine, to find something that hasn't already been, you know, sort of commented on to death.
Well, Heilemann and his co-author,
Halperin,
you know, they face up to that pretty well. And they, when the book gets released, you know, they release two or three or four little sub-excerpts which have all the juice in it. Right. I sort of wonder why this works, but it does. You know, this book has been out for 2 days as we talk. I feel, even if I hadn't read it, just by reading the newspapers and watching a bit of TV, I know all the juicy bits. So why would I go and buy the book? But people do.
It was the cover of New York magazine, I think, this week, and then of course everybody got a leaked copy late last week. What, when you were reading it, what were the parts that jumped out to you? I mean, were they these juicy bits or was there something else that resonated with you?
The best part of the book is sort of in the middle. It was this cavalcade of Republicans where everyone had a week. You know, even Herman Cain had a week. Newt Gingrich had a week. Rick Santorum had a week where they a poll came out showing that they could win or something like that. The authors do a little bit of sort of post hoc reifying. You know, it all looks more solid than it necessarily was. But, and they also pump up these candidates who obviously would never become president, and it, just in order to increase the drama.
Right. You had a you talked about a moment where they talk about Santorum getting 10% in a survey in Iowa as if this, you know, automatically meant winning the presidency.
Yeah, how can anyone ever catch up with him?
What about the style of the book? I mean, a lot of your review was about the ways in which they tried to insert some drama to what was essentially, for many observers, and certainly seems in retrospect, kind of a very expected outcome.
Well, there's something very odd about this book, and I don't really know what the purpose is, which is that they use these words that are usually there's some version of another word that they think lend meaning, but I didn't know what some of them meant. Chasm, C-H-A-S-M.
Chasmal, I think was the...
chasmal, right.
Resembling a chasm.
Yeah, well, all they were saying was someone had taken a big lead in the polls, but they said a chasmic something or other. And then suasive instead of persuasive. And the three or four that I checked, as I say in the review, are real words, but they're not words that really tell you anything. And I don't know what purpose they serve. It's just a strange tick. And they have, when they need a metaphor, they say, somebody is fond of something. I don't remember what. And they say, it's like Dean Martin, you know, and alcohol. But actually, that's a pretty old reference. And it had nothing to do with the narrative. It, you know, there's nothing. This isn't against the law. It's not a terrible crime. It's just very odd.
Well, I have to say, it made reading your review not only highly entertaining, but like a light breeze through a Roger thesaurus, so that I learned some new words and some outdated or updated idiomatic expressions. You talk about chalk and camembert instead of chalk and cheese.
Yes. I mean, what's that about? You know, maybe it all makes sense to someone and I just missed it.
Is the challenge in writing a good book about this, was it just the fact that the characters, you know, the drama just wasn't there? Or do you think that owning this franchise or updating this franchise of the election, sort of TikTok, is increasingly difficult or perhaps impossible?
Well, people say that everybody is sick of politics and politicians, but in practice, there seems to be an endless demand for these narratives and trivia. Politico, as I say, is a huge success in Washington, and that's basically what it is just relentless detail, relentless examination, treating assistant secretaries of agriculture as if they are celebrities, you know. And, of course, these books are all bestsellers. So I'm sort of a bad judge of this. When Politico first came out, I thought, who cares about all this trivia? But I was absolutely wrong.
Everybody look at them now.
And then I read this book, and, you know, I guess I learned a fair amount about it. But you really do have to be a political junkie.
Do you consider yourself a political junkie?
Well, I hope I'm not a political junkie in quite the sense I was talking about. I hope I take at least half a step back and look at a broader perspective. But maybe I don't. Who knows? You can't really judge yourself.
What's the book that you would want to read about this period? That, or, you know, is there something that could be written that would appeal to you?
Well, you know, there are anyone's life is interesting, so they could have, or somebody, if not them, could have written a novel about Mitt Romney. You know, that wouldn't be inconceivable. That could be made interesting, and could talk about, you know, business and an interesting religion and so on. He's sort of in a way, a character out of a novel. I certainly don't have the artistry to do anything like that.
Well, maybe we'll have to wait for Ann Romney's tell-all memoir.
Yeah, she is bitter, I gather.
Yeah,
so that always makes for good copy.
Mike, thank you so much for joining us. The book, again, is Double Down, Game Change 2012 by Mark Halperin and John Heilman. And that was Michael Kinsley, our reviewer this week on the cover of that book. Mike, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, Pam.
Take care.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 150,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. Audible is offering listeners of this podcast a free audiobook when you try Audible free for 30 days. One audiobook to consider is Paddle Your Own Canoe, One Man's Fundamentals for Delicious Living, written and read by Nick Offerman. That's Paddle Your Own Canoe, written and read by Nick Offerman, and it's available on Audible. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/bookreview. That's audible.com/bookreview.
Julie Bosman is here with Notes from the Field. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Pamela.
So what is new out there?
Amazon made an offer this week to independent bookstores, the people and places out there that really are not big fans of Amazon. Amazon said that it was going to offer a program that it was calling Amazon Source that would allow independent bookstores to sell Kindles in their stores and then take a small slice of the profits.
Now, what is in this for the indie bookstore?
Well, as Amazon described it, they said that they think that a lot of customers out there like to buy both print and ebooks, which is true. The bigger question is, why would an independent bookstore want to participate in this program?
Do they get a slice of the sales of books that are sold, ebooks that are sold on devices purchased from their stores?
They would get a small slice of it. The program would allow stores to either buy Kindles for a 6% discount from Amazon and receive 10% of the revenue from the ebooks that customers purchase, or it would give them a 9% discount without any other payment. And the cheapest Kindle out there right now is $69.
So this is kind of turning indie bookstores into Amazon affiliates. It's like their affiliate program for other vendors, right?
Yes. I mean, it would create a situation in which independent bookstores are giving up some display space in their stores to Amazon, an idea that A few independent bookstore owners that I called made them openly laugh at the idea. And also, they would presumably hand over a lot of their customer information to Amazon. So there was a lot of confusion and bewilderment in the independent bookstore world this week about this offer. Some people thought that it was just a joke, that there was no way that Amazon would actually expect anyone to participate. They have obviously a long history of, independent bookstores believe that Amazon is trying to undermine their business. Some of them compared this program to a Trojan horse. And it was something that a lot of indies said that they didn't know who in their right mind would actually take Amazon up on this offer.
Well, there's a pretty clear picture of what their opinion of this looks like.
Absolutely. Well, we'll see. I mean, Amazon says that they just announced the program this week. They haven't really had time to sign up a lot of bookstores, but we'll see over the next few months if anyone decides to take Amazon up on this generous offer.
All right, to be continued. Thanks, Julie.
Thanks, Pamela.
Alyssa Court is the author of Republic of Outsiders, The Power of Amateurs, Dreamers, and Rebels. Alyssa is joining us here now to talk about it. Hi, Alyssa.
Hi, Pamela.
So you have a real argument in this book. Tell us what is it that you're saying about these very different groups outside the mainstream?
I'm saying that these groups are changing the center of American culture in ways that we're not always aware of. They're using the web, they're using social media, they're using their communities to get messages that are often really unexpected across.
So America obviously has a long tradition of, because it's such a large country and for many characteristics that make it open to this, that there have always been these outsider movements that have kind of, become mainstream. I think the most recent one, it seems to my mind, is gay marriage and just the total acceptance of gay and lesbian and increasingly transgendered people. And that was a very radical notion, even only 20 years ago.
Yeah, we were in college.
Yeah. Alyssa and I went to college together. That this could now be a majority opinion would feel shocking just a generation ago. What makes today's sort of fringe movements different?
Today's fringe movements, for one thing, I felt when I was writing this book, I had to try to find corners that not everybody had covered. So I started with more obvious things like tech companies or social movements that people could recognize. I was even thinking at one point the Tea Party. I mean, I started this a while ago. But then I realized that I wanted to find groups that were still in process. So what's interesting to me about these groups is that they're not necessarily, traditional minority group. They're not necessarily traditional,
like identity group.
They're organized by their thinking, their radical thinking. For instance, I write about animal rights activists who have altered the mainstream in very evident ways. If you go into Whole Foods, you see their mark. When you go to the meat aisle, and there's that endless Geneva Convention, as I put it, of guidelines about whether the meat has been slaughtered in a way that is appropriate for these poor animals. So, for instance, that would be one group that is an unusual addition that people wouldn't think, oh, yes, this is going to be what an alternative group is.
I mean, it's interesting because some of this, it's obviously a moving target and moving very quickly. But you talk about the Mad Pride movement. And I think already, in one of my children's schools, for example, there is a neurodiversity group that it's already kind of becoming a more accepted notion.
So I think, for instance, that is a great example of something that when I started writing the book was I was like, this is going to be really on the cutting edge. And within 6 years, it's become absolutely central. There's a clothing line for kids with sensory issues called, I think it's called Soft, which I found totally fascinating. And there's companies like SAP, the German corporation, are now trying to recruit people on the autism spectrum actively. So this is a new, I guess, a burgeoning.
To do what? What are they?
Oh, to work as software testers and tech workers. I don't know all the details of that particular company, but there's a number of companies that are now doing this. So that wasn't true 6 years ago. So it is a moving target in the sense that because of the web, because of these groups' effectiveness, the message gets absorbed so much faster than it did in the past.
One of the things that struck me about the book is that you really look, you know, at very different groups, transgender feminists, this group of Occupy bankers, Occupy Wall Street bankers, which seems like an oxymoron, and you draw kind of the some lines of similarity while also acknowledging that there are differences. This is something that, in a different way, Andrew Solomon did in his book, Far From the Tree. As with his book, there's some rebellion against that very notion that these very different kinds of groups might have something unexpected in common. Did you find that when you were doing your reporting or in the reception to the book that some people said, well, hey, I don't belong with that group?
Well, yeah. I mean, even in this lovely review in the Times, the writer felt like there was one group that shouldn't have been included or wasn't being included in the way she wanted. So I think that is a problem when you're making a broad argument. But I also think that's what's exciting about making one of the kind of argument that, I mean, I hope is exciting in this book. Because if it was just focused in a sort of narrow ethnographic way, it would be closer probably to anthropology. And I think one of the things that's great about somebody like Solomon or, you know, others in our world, in the nonfiction world, is that they can unite seemingly unlike things and say, look, there's this commonality, and they're not bound to this kind of tight, like, oh, yes, it has to always be this one group with this one set of organizing principles. I think, you know, Far From the Tree, right, he even mentioned Mad Pride at some point too, which I was like, ah, it's spreading, it's funny, but you know, there were, and neurodiversity, et cetera.
One of the things that strikes me is that, you know, that it used to take quite a long time for any kind of outsider group to affect the mainstream. I mean, the abolitionist movement is obviously, you know, not just decades, but centuries, and still hasn't fully achieved its goals in many ways, certainly not across the globe. But it seems that with gay marriage and other recent, you know, even the smaller things that you're talking about, the animal rights, for example, that it's moving much more quickly.
It is moving so quickly. And even in the course of writing this book, I had to discard, it's part of why it took so long, I had to discard half of the people I interviewed because they had already been absorbed by the mainstream almost entirely by the time I was ready to write. So I think, again, it is the web. But I also I like to think it's that Americans have become more accepting and more, also in certain ways, more eager for new ideas. So it's not just the web, it's what the web has brought, which is this fixation sometimes on disruption and innovation. So disruptive ideas, instead of shying away from them, I think people are more drawn to them than they might have been in the past.
It also must have some kind of, you know, very pragmatic effect in organizing groups, because it used to be that, you know, I don't know, you know, teeny little fringe groups, like you can name any, but even something like the parent of a child with a very specific disease, for example, would have a very hard time finding other parents who have children in this situation, or people who have, you know, some kind of interest or political affiliation that's way outside the mainstream. But that now, with the internet, with social media, it's much easier to find like-minded groups and then to organize. And that must be...
Well, that's part of the project of this book, was to look at how that worked. So how did 1970s hardcore animal rights become the mass industry that it, you know, the veggie burger has become, right?
Right.
Some of these movements that are still in practice, you're still in process, like mental health movements, for instance, that we were just talking about, how are they speeding things along? How are they making their message heard? And most of it was kind of what you hear over and over again. It's social media. It's creating groups online, using graphics. It's coming up with phrases also, neologisms that really move people. And I guess, again, in a culture of SEOs and all sorts of, you know, cool phrases have an even greater power than they once did. So when you
probably get into the Oxford English Dictionary even faster than they once did.
Yeah, that would be we need to call, what's his name, Jesse Scheinflauer or whatever. But I mean,
the editor of the American editor of the Oxford English Dictionary.
I mean, I would only imagine that these phrases and these movements, identity sobriquets would be absorbed faster and faster and are doing so.
The book is Republic of Outsiders, The Power of Amateurs, Dreamers, and Rebels. Read it while these people are still in the outside the mainstream. The author is Alyssa Court. Alyssa, thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thank you, Pamela.
This week is our biggest children's book issue of the year, in which we also include our 10 best illustrated books of 2013. Joining us now is Sarah Harrison-Smith, our children's book editor, to talk about what's in the issue and a little bit about those best illustrated books. Hi, Sarah.
Hello.
Is there any sort of trend that emerges or anything that struck you about the issue this year overall?
Well, this is a very big issue with 24 pages, which is wonderful. And one of the things that we noticed when we were going through the bookshelves was how many books on Africa there suddenly seemed to be. I think there's a real interest in this subject. I think maybe because there's a lot of news coming out of Africa these days and people are wondering, you know, how can I tell my children more about this place that in some ways seems so far away and in some ways seems very close. We have a nice juxtaposition of a review by Sarah Corbett of a new novel about a girl who's taken hostage off the Somali coast by Somali pirates. That's Nick Lake's new book, Hostage 3.
And Nick won the Prince Award last year for his book about Haiti. So he's really looking at kind of hot areas around the world.
Topical issues, that's right. And this is a really fun novel for older readers, but there are a lot of books on the market for younger readers too that we were able to showcase in our bookshelf about Africa. And so we have a reworking of Old MacDonald Had a Farm that's set in Africa. Now Old Macomba Had a Farm, all the way to historical stories about girls like the one who was on the Amistad ship and managed to make her way back to Africa after being taken captive and brought to America against her will.
Well, I have to say, my daughter is in third grade and they're studying Africa this semester, and she has been working on a month-long homework project in which she had to pick a country in Africa. She, of course, picked Madagascar, and we went around to several libraries, and it was kind of hard to find good children's books for, you know, that first through fourth or fifth grader about the continent.
Well, it's really nice to see this new wave of books that, you know, stretch all the way from appealing to 2-year-olds to appealing to probably 11 or 12-year-olds.
Let's talk about the best illustrated books this year. We had three great judges. You want to tell us a little bit about who it was who picked the books? Because, of course, it's not us at The Times who chooses these, but a panel of three.
That's right. The Times is very hands-off about this other than choosing the judges. And we've been doing this since 1952. So it's a long-standing prize. And our judges this year were Brian Selznick, who many people know from his wonderful book, Hugo Cabret, Betsy Bird, a librarian with the New York Public Library, who is also the author of a picture book and a forthcoming book about, I think it's about rebellion in children's literature.
And a very popular book blogger, too.
Exactly. Yes, a very popular book blogger. She really knows that world so well. And Steve Heller, who was for many years an art director at The Times and is currently chairman of the MFA Design as Author and Entrepreneur Program at the School of Visual Arts.
And also our visual columnist for the book review.
That's right. So they went through thousands of books, and it's a day-long process, and they discussed every single one of the books that they thought were contenders for the Best Illustrated Award. And they came up with 10 very different, each very beautiful books. What's special about this award, among other things, is that they don't consider the text at all. So it's not about the combination of text and visual images. It's just about the visual imagery.
And also different from the Caldecott, it's not just for American authors and illustrators, but also represents talent from around the world, which I think is very evident in this year's selection.
That's right. I mean, not only do we have talent that many Americans are familiar with, like Maurice Sendak, who received the award this year posthumously. But we also have Lex Bilex, who is based in Germany. We have illustrators who are based in Canada and Holland, and also, I believe, South America, the book Jemmy Button, written and illustrated by Jennifer Uman and Valerio Vidali from Templar Candlewick.
There were also some interesting repeats on the list this year. Nelson Mandela, written and illustrated by Kadir Nelson. He has, of course, been on the Best Illustrated list before, as has John Klassen, who is a relative newcomer to the world of children's books, but won this year for The Dark, which was written by Lemony Snicket.
That's right. Always a favorite with children's book readers.
Another international presence is, of course, Tommy Ungerer, who was a friend of Sendak's and in his 80s now, living in Ireland, and with his book that he wrote, both wrote and illustrated, Fog Island.
Yeah, that's an extraordinary book with a very strange and mysterious story, but the pictures are extraordinarily dramatic. They seem almost sort of three-dimensional, and they really convey some of the sort of rugged romance of the Irish coast.
What is so amazing to me, I mean, one of the many things about Tommy Ungerer, and he was the subject of a terrific documentary film this year that came out in the fall, but is his versatility and his, I mean, this, the style in this book is very different from the books that early on that made him a favorite. I'm thinking of The Three Robbers and the Mellip series, and this is sort of very moody and painterly and romantic. And
it has, and the pictures have a depth, which I believe that those earlier works didn't have. They had a sort of flatter primary color sense about them. And this is a move away from that. In addition to someone like Ungerer, who has a long history, we have debut artists like Aaron Becker, whose book Journey, also out from Candlewick, is his first picture book effort. And I think really an extraordinary book.
And that made the bestseller list. And it's, is it wordless or nearly wordless?
It's wordless, that's right. Although the action is borne about through the use of a red crayon, but it's all about visuals, yes.
It's kind of a, for those who haven't seen it, in a little way, an update on Harold and the Purple Crayon. It's kind of has that imaginative journey of one's own creation story. The other wordless book, I think, was Holland.
That's right. Holland is a very unusual book by Charlotte Demitons. It has no words, and it has these very detailed, shows these very detailed scenes of the of Holland, and it's beautiful and interesting. There's a lot to pore over in this book. This is not a book you just flip through. This is a book that you lay open on a table and then stare at each picture for several minutes, I think.
The book came out in the Netherlands and first, and it's interesting because I had shared it with some Dutch families at one of my children's schools, and they said, well, you know, it's hard to imagine how anyone other than the Dutch could appreciate this book because it has all of these little elements of Dutch culture and history embedded deep into the pictures, and if you weren't Dutch, you wouldn't know about it. But I think that that's one of the great abilities of a good picture book, is to open up that world to children, and even if they don't catch every single reference, that they're kind of transported into this very different place.
That's right. Whether it's Holland or Africa, they can learn a lot from them and also enjoy them just on a purely sort of visual level.
Well, thank you, Sarah, for that.
Thank you so much, Pamela.
That was Sarah Harrison-Smith, our children's book editor, talking about this year's Best Illustrated Books and the biggest children's book review issue of the year. Greg Coles is here with Bestseller News. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Pamela.
What's new on the fiction list this week?
Well, I'm going to talk about the hardcover list. In fiction, at number two, we have a book called After Dead. That is by Charlene Harris, who, of course, wrote the Sookie Stackhouse books that became the basis for True Blood. And she had really ended that Sookie Stackhouse series, but like John Updike with the Rabbit books or Richard Ford with the Frank Bascombe books, she couldn't stay away, and she's returned with like a little coda here. That's called After Dead, new at number two. At number four, Danielle Steele has a book called Winners. That is just a new novel from Danielle Steele. I will briefly point out that on the combined list, she also has a new nonfiction book called Pure Joy, that is a celebration of the dogs in her life.
Danielle Steele plus dogs equals surefire bestseller.
On the combined list, that's new at number 7. Her novel Winners is new at number 4 on the hardcover list. Lisa Scottolini, the female legal thriller writer and a lawyer herself, has a new novel called Accused. That takes up her Mary D'Annunzio series about an all-female law firm and is new at number 7 on the list. Then new at number 8, there's a book called S. It is officially by Doug Dorst, but he wrote it in collaboration with the writer and director J.J. Abrams, who did the Star Trek.
Star Trek, and he's going to do Star Wars. He's just becoming the dominant star franchise.
Although this book is not science fiction, it presents itself as a book from 1949 called Ship of Theseus by a guy named V.M. Straka. But in fact, is filled with all kinds of marginalia and postcards, things kind of stuffed into the book. And the real novel, the story itself, unfolds in that marginalia where a couple of researchers are talking back and forth. So shades of, like, Pale Fire there. And J.J. Abrams conceived the book and went to the novelist Doug Dorst to, ask for his help writing it. And Doug Dorst ended up writing the book. So that's new at number 8. And then the last new book on the hardcover fiction list this week is by Karen Kingsbury. It's called 15 Minutes, and it's a novel about a reality TV show. Then on the nonfiction side of things, there are just 3 new titles. Pat Conroy, who, you know, the author of Prince of Tides and The Great Santini and longtime best-selling novelist and nonfiction writer, has a memoir called The Death of Santini, and it follows up. The Great Santini, of course, was based on his very troubled relationship with his father, his abusive father. And The Death of Santini is mourning the death of that father, who remained kind of a larger-than-life figure throughout Pat Conroy's life, but they finally reconciled. So this is kind of a son's tribute to his father, looking back on that relationship. That's new at number 4. New at number 12, the comedian Artie Lang has an addiction memoir called Crash and Burn. He wrote that with Anthony Baza. He talks about his depression in there and then his addiction and his recovery. The last new book on the hardcover nonfiction list this week is by the former New York Times reporter Philip Shennan. It's called A Cruel and Shocking Act, and it goes back and revisits the Warren Commission and talks about evidence that was withheld from the commission by official government sources, the FBI, the CIA, and pulls back the covers and looks at maybe what was left out of the Warren Commission.
That's we'll have to see by the 22nd just how many JFK books dominate the bestseller
list.
We
may have an all JFK nonfiction list.
All right. Well, coming up soon. Thank you, Greg.
Thanks, Pamela.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.